you're reading in Rejuvenative Powers for the Man. And as we're reading here, and Ishel will read aloud here, the woman can give vital energy to the man by certain Kama Sutra positions and so on, by a transference of this vital life force. So, and this is also a Taoist method as well, transferring vital chi.
Well, I was just reading that the word ritual actually comes from the red gold kind of alchemical ritual. Ritu. And so the actual origin of ritual is the transference of the menstrual blood.
You're listening to Fane of the Cosmos, Infinite Moment, and this is a recast of a show from 2001 featuring Ishel, Aaron, Jason, and our beloved Ian Hunter, who passed away later that year in a tragic drowning in Kootenai Lake. God bless you, Ian. We love you. I'm so glad to have him back on the air. This hour of Fane of the Cosmos is brought to you by El Taco Mexican Restaurant. Yes, we even have sponsors here. So stay tuned. We're going to get back. This is it's full moon tonight at, I think, 2 in the morning. So this is our full moon menstrual blood show. Here we go.
And it's interesting that women who live together also menstruate at the same time, whether or not we notice it. And so psychically, I think that women have collective power. And I have memory of that with my sisters in this life, but also in past life, of having powerful moon lodges. And the psychic space that can be created through that is just incredible. And so, you know, taking away our cycles just through erratic chemicals and things that our environment take us away from who we really are, but really deep inside of our psyches we really know, and our bodies have a knowledge beyond our own minds, that when we're around presence of other women, and I've noticed that with my mother and my sister, that we'd be menstruating at the same time, and then our dreams would coincide. And you know, my mother would have dreams of me hundreds of miles away, and our menstruation would be at the same time. So there's something really deep about when we conceive, when we menstruate, and connection with our mothers and our sisters on this planet.
Well, it seems that also, like, I'll read the Starfire excerpt, perhaps after Ishel reads that excerpt, but the pineal gland, or the menstrual fluid, actually contains a lot of excretions from the pineal gland, and so the DMT, dimethyltryptamine, the serotonin, and all that is part and parcel with psychic phenomenon, with telepathy, such as that. And so that is, I think, the mechanism through which women line up their menstrual periods through that resonance that they have with them when they live together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating.
There's also a heavy iron content in menses, and you know, that's the highly magnetic substance. Like, I think one of the things that's always convinced me about it, astrology to a certain degree, I wouldn't say I'm completely convinced, but I'm definitely listening, was just when someone explained it to me as a phenomenon of magnetics, you know, planetary magnetics, that, like, there was an actual electrical or magnetic influence that each planet had on the other planets, and that every star had on each star, and that all bodies of matter had on every other body of matter. And it makes sense to me that there would be an inherent increase in magnetism during that time of that cycle for women.
During that flow.
Yeah, both the spiritual and the material magnetism, for sure.
Yeah.
And due to this incredible increase in power that women have when they're bleeding, and the in-tune nature that they have in the other worlds, would explain one of the reasons why the patriarchy would want to stop women from bleeding together, stop women from being together in this moment of power, when they can really come together as one and bridge those worlds, those spirit realms, with the physical actual release of blood, which is life force. I'm going to read an excerpt here from Sexual Secretions, Sexual Secrets. I don't know if we've gone over that yet, but the root of the word secret being secretions of bodily fluids. Yes, I know everyone's resonating with that right now.
Also, a flower comes from flower.
Yes.
And the reason that a lot of the early biblical name for women are actually named after flowers, like Lilith, like for Lily and all that, is because they're Menzies priestesses, presumably.
So, in the tantric tradition, a woman is viewed as a virgin, Kumari, just after menstruation, as a young wife, Sarasvati, during menstruation, or during the following week of menstruation, and as a worldly mistress of the house during the next week, and as a wise lady during the approach to menstruation. And during the menses, she is beyond worldliness, dead to the world and its responsibilities, and therefore freed from household duties. And it's during this time that she serves a link between this world and the next as high priestess. Yeah, this sacred role. As mother and sustainer of the family, a woman spends the majority of her time caught up in the worldly world. And this is her time to walk between the worlds.
Menstruation is only for a matter of days, and God willed that it be used to totally purify and cleanse the womb. When it's all over, a woman is better than before. And that's the Shakya Nefzawi, something like that. So, does not matter who it is, it's just some words of wisdom that it is total purification of the psyche and spirit and release. And then I really resonate with the aspect of being virgin right after, because you feel like your cup has been emptied, ready to receive again, like the moon in all her phases.
There was a book too I was reading called The Red Tent, where in Hebrew cultures the women would, during their menstrual cycle, retire to one tent, and that because the time that the moon would come, that they would end up together in the tent, and then that would become a very powerful ceremony, but also a time when women could share knowledge of childbirth and sexual secrets, and it was a real powerful, the red tent was considered like a very powerful ceremony.
And that links back to Ashina and the womb lodge that they're creating, and that's exactly the space they're trying to create there, that they are creating there. It's because women do, when they synchronize, and it has to do with pheromones and just the release of hormones. And I was also told by a belly dancer that one way of synchronizing your moon is to smell each other's armpits. And this pheromone like exchange synchronizes your moons within days. And it's important. That was like, this is the time when women come together, like you said, and share the secrets, share the power, share the knowledge, the ritual, and walk between the worlds.
And the tent, the symbol of the womb within the womb too, and the secret, the secreting,
the secretions.
I love this. This gotta happen more often.
There's an amazing little excerpt here that I was going to read. It's yet again talking about the tantric beliefs. And it says, the tantric form is for the man, and this is in lovemaking, to lie down while the woman sits above him. And she takes the active role without shame or sexual restraint, and she makes love to him, pouring the downward moving energy and the libation of the menstrual flow on his erect lingam. From her, he receives the invigorating essence of her ova-rich blood, which would have been the basis for supporting the life of a fetus, and she experiences a loss of menstrual pains and cramps. So there's like an exchange, like the yin-yang coming together as this experience. So it is a very positive experience, and unfortunately through the patriarchy, because of the amount of power that a woman exudes during this time. And, I don't know, men's we won't go into that at this moment. It's too big. But
maybe I'm sort of odd for man, but I've never like figured out why men, and like for that matter women, are so like phobic and weird about their menstrual fluid. Like, it just, I didn't get it. You know, I didn't get why, you know, women's tampon ads never had a spot of blood in them. And
look at that, you know, beautiful blue bleach stain right there. That's so natural.
Or just that, like, if you were with your girlfriend and one of her little tampon bullets fell out of her purse, she'd be like, and put it back, and you're like, what? What's the big deal?
Yeah. Where did this come from? Yeah.
Or when the boyfriend's at the supermarket having to buy the tampons, and he's got that funny look on his face. Yeah.
They're cricket
pads. Must have come from way back when the goddess and the god were shamed at some point, kind of in connection with sort of the male circumcision thing, sexual taboo, what's dirty. I think it stems from there.
Well, I think also what happened, like one of the excerpts I was, we did this great reading of excerpts from the Women's Mysteries at this as well, and I read the excerpt on how during the Middle Ages women would be like shunned from the village, and they'd be left to fend for themselves, like outside the village in the wilderness, and then be fed on sticks. Like, you weren't allowed to touch them. You know, they weren't allowed to touch themselves. You know, it's like, there was like, it went from, you know, this is the woman's power to, you know, this is the most like horrible, disgusting thing around. And still in some cultures, it's, well, I guess in this culture for that matter, it's very much like that.
I think that's a really popular custom in a lot of African tribes as well, is to not revere but actually fear the menstrual cycle in the woman, and to separate them not out of reverence but out of actual, like, they're terrified of it. For instance, a friend of mine who was studying anthropology told me about a situation where if a woman who was menstruating, but if a drop of blood happened to fall on the ground near these men, these like big grown warrior men would like run like mice. I mean, it terrified them in a way that like wasn't very explicable. I mean, it was just obviously a culture taboo that had been deeply rooted in their psyche. Like, I'm afraid of spiders, you know, I can confront it, but my initial reaction is like, ugh. And I think that's probably just like a deep-rooted subconscious. I've never had a bad experience with this spider.
According to Sir Lawrence Gardner, who wrote this Starfire book and wrote the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, it actually goes back to Noah's time. So it's like way, way back. And even though the origins of it are the Anunnakan menstrual alchemical factories, essentially. What eventually came down to us is the whole kind of repression of the matriarchy by the patriarchy, and the key to that repression was the phobia imposed by the menstrual blood.
But in some Mayan cultures, it was actually the men would imitate the woman's menstrual cycle by having the king pierce the bottom of his testicles and pour that blood into the vessel in order to imitate the woman's menstrual cycle, and they had to do this repeatedly in a cycle, like a woman. And so, I don't know about being a king in those cultures, it must have been...
Oh, this was a king?
This was a king would have to do this, yeah.
Wow.
And into a bowl, and do it in a cyclical fashion to imitate the fertility of the earth.
I'm wondering if that those secretions on a monthly basis would have some of the same chemicals
maybe close to the testicles, but they had to actually pierce repeatedly the bottom of their
And I'm wondering if perhaps the Christian church or like Christianity has something to do with the fact that women, that menstrual blood be so taboo, considering like death is such a, you know, hell and all these kind of concepts that Christianity brings up, and blood being related to death may have this, you know, like you're saying, the African tribes are, you know, afraid, like literally afraid, running away from this.
But that, I think for them it's more of like a magical kind of thing, like a curse, in the idea that when the moon is out, it's the female portion of the heavens is in power, and therefore the woman's you know, it's kind of like a magical thing. Like, I know in some ceremonies or in some tribes that women are not in certain ceremonies if they're on their moon, because it might affect the spirits or they're too powerful, or, you know, so maybe it's a fear of that kind of magical principle.
You know, one of the things I learned at this Moon Lodge ceremony as well is that the quality of the woman's menstrual period when she has it reflects the stress that she'd gone through in the previous moon. And so if she's had like a really kind of stressful moon, you know, bad diet, lots of boundary invasions, lots of stress, such like that, then she's more likely to have a rough moon because of that. Or even
not have a moon, which can happen as well. As women will stop bleeding if there's too much stress in their lives. They will hold that power because they need that power.
They can't let it go. It's too...
They don't have enough power. They don't have enough energy. Life source to be returned.
To also note that women who are afraid of being pregnant and are consumed with worry will delay their moon time as well, several weeks. So there's some psychic connection with our body release as well.
And even look at our school system. Like, I don't know what your reaction was by your peers and by your family when you had your first moon cycle, but were you celebrated? Were you covered in flowers? And
it was my first day of grade 7.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my mom was in, it was my teacher, grade 7. Homeroom class.
Luckily, but there was no celebration.
No celebration. Was like, I actually felt a bit of shame, but I also felt this beauty as well. Like, I felt, I'm a woman in my first day of grade 7.
See, that should be celebrated. In the school system, we should have, when a woman gets her first moon cycle, that, all right, we take the day off. She is the symbolic goddess, and for that day, I don't know, dressed in flowers, maybe have a special... Yeah, worshipped. But we don't have that. Instead, it's this kind of shame thing, like, Aaron, you have to go home.
Well, it's interesting. There was,
you know, like,
just a kind of a comparison of male and female energies. I remember this boy in my class would stand for O Canada, and he had a raging erection. And, you know, you can help but not notice being a 13-year-old. But I remember the feelings of shame, but also awe as well. So, you know, there's a lot more in our psyche than we realize, and it's taken many, many years to unravel a lot of these mysteries and these feelings that we have. But honoring, we're starting to honor right here, right now. It's all we can do.
Sealu Corn Woman, one of the four crones at the Moon Lodge, who wrote this book on menstruation and menstruation ritual. She was, the book talked about how, about the importance of rites of passage, and about how we've kind of lost that you know, those important transitions. And so that's why, I think that's one of the reasons that we're kind of confused growing up, because our body changes, our experience changes, but we're still kind of living in the past where it's an uncomfortable tradition sometimes. And there, I'm not sure if I read it there, but there's some Native Indian tradition, I believe, where the woman who is about to get her first moon is chased off into the bush by the either by the witch doctor or by the medicine man, and then her blood finally bursts, and then she chases him back because of that whole like thing. So, which is kind of a neat ritual, and I'm not sure if it entirely symbolizes it was positive, but it's pretty neat. But Sealu, by the way, we're actually losing, as it turns out, a great and largely untapped resource in the Kootenays with Sealu Corn Woman, because she's actually going back to the coast. She's getting on in age, and when she moved here about a year ago, she thought that she'd be doing lots of ceremony, that people wanted her up here and such like that. But sometimes, last winter, like 3 weeks would go by before somebody would visit. And this is like an older woman. She has a hard time getting around. I mean, she's a noted author. She's led lots of workshops for the last like 20 or 30 years. But she's actually moving to Roberts Creek at the end of this month.
The only time I've met her, I never saw her again, but she was at a Samhain Halloween festival last year. And she was speaking in the direction, for the direction of the east, I believe, and maybe the west. But she said like the most profound words of the ritual to me, and it seemed like she was talking directly to me. Although, you know, she was speaking to everyone. She said something about, you know, to really discover yourself and a place, you have to pick a place and stay there for a long time, which was totally relevant to me. I'm not from the area, and like I've never really lived anywhere for a very long time. And it just like struck me deeply, and that was not the only thing. I just had a lot of profound respect for her. I'm sure the community will indeed miss her. It's too bad that people didn't turn on to that resource while it was here.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't know that Sila was here and who she is.
Yeah. So, just one of those profound, magical, powerful people that they walk into the room and everyone's just, mm-hmm. Or that's how I thought she was. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. So she's moving to Gibson's. So if you have any friends there, then Sila's coming.
Here comes Corn Woman. I was thinking of another thing while we're on the topic of just all the various traditions, uses, poetries of the Menzies. One thing that occurs to me, I've studied and somewhat practiced various forms of Western magic for about 2.5, maybe 3 years now, and one of the things that definitely recurs is sex magic and references to it allegorically mostly, and every once in a while directly. But a weird twist is that black magic, let's say, which is something that after I've studied this that I don't actually believe in as a separate entity at all, but traditionally what is black magic is more relative to blood magic, which because of the suppression of Menzies was perverted by people who didn't know the origin of the tradition, who would actually kill animals or other people or somehow get blood for these rituals in ways that were particularly offensive to most people with moral standards. But had they known the key and the essence to the magic was in the Menzies, there would have been no murder or no violence. It would have been a cooperative affair, most likely. Women would have been able to maintain their power as witches or as powerful women in the Western culture. And the thing is that one of the things I feel like I've discovered is a bit of a secret. Maybe everyone in this room knows about it, but it took me quite a while to discover what it was about sex magic that was so powerful. And if it's the Menzies, where it's sort of like the woman's semen, and but it doesn't give birth to material beings. It gives birth to immaterial beings. It gives birth in the subconscious for powerful means or ideas that we've, sigils or mantras that we've empowered with meaning. At the point of climax, orgasm, when the fluids are exchanged, that being, that sigil, is actually given birth to in the material realm, probably firstly through the subconscious realm. But all manifestations begin in the realm of ideas. So it's this magic to actually change the world you live in profoundly. It's the most powerful tool that we could possibly be given. It's the most ancient and still the most profound technology humanity has, and yet none of us know about it. Or how very few of us have practiced it on the entire world at any given time.
Yeah, it's been so successfully repressed.
Yeah,
and when you think of it, like the Taoists talk about how women should be doing their qi cultivation practices in microcosmic orbits at all times, except during their moon, because that's when her qi dump is happening. That's how women actually lose their qi during their moon cycle. Whereas men lose it through their ejaculation. And so so it kind of makes sense that you'd have a whole month's full of qi actually coming out. And in sex magic, you bring everything to that point of orgasm where you burn the sigil or where you cast the wish or whatever. But I can see it being much more powerful in terms of actually using women's menstrual blood.
All right, you're listening to Fan of the Cosmos, Infinite Moment. We've been going back in time to 2001 in an interview. Well, not an interview. God. A show with a show. Aaron, Jason, Ian Hunter, and myself talking about menstrual blood, the magical secretion, the secrets, and I thought it was so perfect for the full moon tonight. We'll continue on with the next part now. I'm not sure where the CD starts up, but this is Ian Hunter. I hope Ian's on this one.
I'm not sure if you've already gone over this or not.
She almost spilled the red cup.
That is, that, yeah. With bodily secretions, perhaps. We haven't gone over the you're in or you're out.
I think we did last week, did a couple you? Weeks ago.
Okay,
ago.
Great.
The straw, though, the drinking box.
You're in or you're out. Tune in for more of bodily secrets, secretions. Better ask what's in that mate cup before you take a sip.
Well, just for not necessarily for safety's sake, but I guess for shared boundaries, energy's sake. I'm going to be producing urine or you're out mate mug stickers, and so probably available soon at the Holy Smoke, I would imagine. And,
actually, there's going to be a mate palace opening up at Cornejo Blanco soon. Yeah,
it's
going to be a bunch of different flavors, and I think Jay's working on it.
Mm, all right, so another place to have mate in town here.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so it seems that like the crazes. Sweeping through Nelson, first mate, now urine.
People came.
Next, menstrual blood.
Menstrual blood coming soon.
Oh God, drinking
and
box.
And semen, why not?
Yeah.
The secret's out.
Oh my God. People travel here and they're just like, they just can't believe it. Like, you're walking down the street with a mate gourd and they're like, what? I was in South America. What? You know, they just can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
In Little Nelson, like.
I think it's because we have a critical mass of open individuals here. You know, so yeah, it's like it only took like what a month for the urine craze to hit Nelson hard. You know, and so yeah, now everybody seems to be doing it. So why aren't you?
Why don't we? Yeah, we're gonna have a pee in.
Oh yeah, yeah. We
where everybody comes and
a urine.
a urine. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what, people? It tastes good. Yeah. It really does.
I guess we should impart some urine secrets that we've learned. So only take the middle part of your urine. That is, pee 4 seconds, hold it. Put your mate / urine mug down. Pee. And don't pee right to the end. Leave a little for the, I guess, whatever waste products you have. And it actually combines really well with wheatgrass, surprisingly. And because wheatgrass is chlorophyll, which is very similar to blood hemoglobin. And so urine is actually filtered blood.
Please try this at home.
Please try this at home.
And just to let you all know, that urine is actually
97.
97% water. And
1% minerals, 1% vitamins, I think 0.5% dead blood cells, and 0.5% waste.
Yeah, so if you're not getting enough water, you can be drinking your pee and getting water that way as well.
And the more... And the more you pee, the more you drink your urine, the more you want to pee, and the more you drink the urine, your pee, the better your urine tastes. And so it actually goes through quicker.
It's like a biofeedback.
Yeah.
Your body, by tasting the urine, knows what minerals are being taken out of the body and can set its dial so that your body is functioning smoother.
But it's your very own personalized antibiotic. Very own personalized medicine made just for you by your own body.
We're not talking saying you drink a pint of it here in a sitting, but adding some to you.
As a matter of fact...
Whoa, wait a second.
I was just on the coast recently, and this is when the urine or you're out stage of my life began. And my friend happens to be a 52-year-old, extremely healthy, vibrant juggler who spends his life performing for people and making people laugh. He's been drinking his pee for 6 months now, noticing his eyesight is getting better, his hair is thicker, his skin is softer, he smells better, and he drinks his pee every single time he goes to pee. And we were kind of giggling at Green Cuisine in Victoria, both of us going, "Ooh, I have to go pee now," running into the bathroom with our Green Cuisine cups. And when we came out, both kind of with a nice glint in our eye, looking at each other and giggling, and he asked me how much pee I drank. And I kind of pointed with my finger, you know, about an inch. And he looked at me surprisingly and said, "Oh, I drank a glass and a half." And I was quite surprised at the time, but honestly, after a month, I understand what he's talking about.
Oh my God, I'm sorry, I'm working with this. Like, I'm picturing a shot glass. I'm not up to like glass of draft or a pint. Like, sorry, I'm still in the shooter stage. Yeah. Okay,
it's also the first pee in the morning is the best, because that's where you get your 4-hydroxymelatonin is on your
from
first
the
pee
sleep
in the morning.
Thing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I remember Strassman talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got an email from Strassman back inquiring about psychedelics and urine. And
that's what I was going to ask. When you do drugs and you drink your urine the next day, do you get high all over again?
I think it works a bit, and presumably Siberian shaman use it for Amanita mushrooms, which is bufotene or 5-hydroxy-DMT. Apparently, you can do it up to 7 times, or 7 P cycles. The molecule will still be around. It should be that way for like all tryptamines, but I haven't noticed a remarkable kind of like high kicking up afterwards. And according to Strassman, the MOA inhibitor will mostly break down the psychedelics before it actually gets through your urine. And so I think some psychedelics will pass through, but not all. But of course, that is a job for the Valhalla Institute to determine this.
We're looking for volunteers now.
So we'll be on the case, and we'll publish eventually in a quarterly journal.
How does this affect kissing? There's something different.
Wasn't it said that the Egyptians believed that ingesting your urine is like an elixir of immortality? And I actually experienced this one night on a psychedelic journey with the moon shining down on the lake. And this was the first time I had ever ingested my urine. And I looked at the moon and I knew. And this was the highest act of self-love that I had ever done in my life. And the invigoration I experienced after that was as though I was immortal. So that was my first experience, which is highly transcendental. And somehow innately our souls know the secret of ingesting our urine under the influence of psychedelics and recycling that back into your body. You're not losing the essence of the sacrament.
And in fact, it actually is an elixir of immortality, because including the menstrual blood, semen and urine all contain essential vitamins and nutrients, omegas and et cetera, that were allowing the Anunnaki and these various tribes to live into the 200, 300 year age range, which has been proven scientifically. So these are truly elixirs of immortality.
Yeah, so... the code words that I've developed for this is, of course, for urine, remember this, take out your pen, you're in or you're out, and...
Can you go over that one more time?
Yeah, yeah.
I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
You're in or you're out.
Okay, okay.
I was actually trying to write that phonetically. You're in, you're out.
Yeah, I think...
Or you're in or you're out.
I figure for semen, for semen or sexual secretions. Secret secretions. Right. It's based on the Wilhelm Reichian principle of fascism being caused by the repressed orgasm. If you take the Taoist approach of having ejaculations versus ejaculations, then you're still having that pleasure principle, but you're not losing anything. So I figure that based on that, pleasure for peace is the would be the code for that.
Global orgasms.
Yeah. And of course the phrase that pays for you closet Menzies worshippers out there is red gold.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
So maybe, should we go to
let's have a song. This one's called One Blood, and it's from
one
the
blood,
this is from the Dubs
heart.
Dub Central.
Let's drink the cup and feel all right.
Feel it in the one cup.
Immortality.
So this is a Save Salt Spring Dance benefit for Texada Island. And this is Dub Central at Beaver Point Hall. Okay, here we go.
Find him. one blood. One blood. One blood.
This hour of Fin of the Cosmos is brought to you by El Taco Mexican Restaurant. Andale! Get your ass down there and get some tasty food. This show has been dedicated to all the women out there who are having their moons right now. We honor you. We bless you. We thank you. Susan Weed, who we interviewed on the show just a few months ago, said the most important thing that women can do in the world to save the earth is give their blood back to the earth. So we bless you. Happy full moon. Our thoughts are with you. Listeners, I hope we don't get too choked to me. I'm gonna we do 3.5 FM Kootenai Incorporated. What usually happens is that we start talking while the music is playing, and that's when the real juicy stuff comes out. So we're gonna dive right in with Ian telling us that they have some kind of vending machine?
We're talking about
pheromones. Pheromones.
Young listeners out there, close your ears.
Parental advisory. Anybody listening to this could learn something. So I don't know what you're supposed to do in that situation. I think just keep listening, but it might shock you.
Yeah, well, we're discussing pheromones and how, like instead of using your girls, instead of using your Chanel number 5, just don't wash for a couple of days and work out, sweat, and take your hand, put it underneath your armpit, and then rub it over your
rub it right in the secretial juices and rub that on your neck.
Oh.
Yes, that's the... Yoni number 5.
Yeah, and see the and see Yo-no. The men and I guess women run towards you, and so
they'll be like,
"So
hi."
While we're on the topic of pheromones and fragrance, and believe me, what I'm about to say is definitely less or probably more kosher than what the conversation that was going on off the air. But my fiance and I have been enjoying each other sexually for about almost 2 years now. And
you're not married yet?
Not married yet.
Okay, let's just get that clear.
But it's gonna happen someday. About like say 5-6 months into our relationship, we started noticing that my armpits smelled like her yoni. And it's never gone away. And some days it's just so pronounced that like she's not even home, and I think she's standing right next to me. It's like, it's not my pheromone smell. I've actually chemically changed the way that I odor. Yeah.
Well, there is a proximity with people who are attracted to each other, have to like the smell of their pheromones. It's actually not possible to actually be attracted to somebody you don't like the smell of.
Totally, and that's the thing you learn. Like as a young man, I learned that if I was masking my smell, there was no chance for me to meet that other person and have all the triggers go off because I was masking all the parts that would have that possibility happen. So after I got rid of the right stick, right guard, the pit stick, and the the spray on antiperspirant. That means anti-sweat, anti-smell, anti-whatever your body's doing to express its sexuality. And it's, even the men produce pheromones at the stage when they're most fertile and ready to, have their... Yeah, they're just like, I'm ready. Well, you're not going to get that signal. A woman's not going to smell that if you've covered it over in perfumes and gels and sticky, gooey. Ugh.
It's almost like it's one of those another repressive conspiracy, to shut our smells down, it's pretty weird. But did you hear about they did the study where they took I think like 17 football jerseys, laid them out, and then brought the cheerleaders in, and without telling them, which jerseys were which football players, the cheerleaders chose the jerseys that were opposite them the most. So the theory was that they went for the most distinctly different DNA in order that's what they were actually attracted to. So it was like. Yeah, the most novel, which is interesting because it's actually opposite to that of the kingship thing, where the Anunnakin, going back to the previous conversation, that the passing on of the matrilineal line of the House of David and such like that, the choosing of kings still today in Europe, is like based on who your mother was, essentially. And so they're going for that inbred, high Anunnakin kind of blood thing versus the natural instinct to go for as diverse and different a DNA spiral as yours.
But they were there, so they're trying to preserve the little G God super blood, like super being kind of blood, right?
Yeah.
So would that balance it out? Or
well,
what
I,
do
think,
you think,
I think
like the
I think
inbreeding
the
re- versus.
But
the,
I think the reason they do that is because by natural instinct you're going to be you know, going for as you know, far away from your DNA spiral as you can.
Oh, I see. To another planet.
Well, to well, hopefully not to another species, or maybe not, but you know, if you're white, you want to go for the black, I guess. You know,
so. It's more of that freak power, I think.
Yeah.
Kind of brings up about the love boundary issues. You know, it brings to mind like the cheating husband comes home and he smells like another woman, and women have such a honing device of smell. In terms of, I've heard of experiments before. The same kind of thing with the jock shirts or jock straps or whatever you talked about.
Jerseys or jock straps, yeah.
They're husband's shirts.
Yeah. I can just picture that.
Yeah, maybe there's somewhere there's like soiled jock straps and like men deprived places where a woman like stick the loonies.
But
in.
The point being that a woman can point out or smell out her husband's shirt.
Okay, but I'm going to tell you something too. Guys can sniff a pair of their own underwear and give you like an hour, minute, day kind of like 2 days, 4 hours, five. You know what I mean? Like we know how long we've been wearing our clothes. Like, you know what I mean? Like this shirt, okay, no. You know what I mean? Have you ever seen that? Like bachelors are like, ah, it's still okay. Turn it inside out, it'll be fine. We have a
walking out of the house by themselves.
Oh. So everybody out there, smell your way to love.
So maybe that's where that repulsion comes in, you know, going a little too far like we are. But, you know, we're just, it's all in good humor.
Jitterbug perfume, it's pheromones, the smell, the flower, the bee, the juices, the sweat, everything all tied into olfactory.
It turns out there's like a lot of medicines and presumably a lot of perfumes that are actually from these secretions. Anyways, they don't tell you what medicines are actually from, like the urine of horses and the menses.
All musk. Musk is always from bull testicle. That's what the word means. It means a particular fragrance from a bull testicle. So if you're getting like a patchouli, or you're choosing between a patchouli or a patchouli musk, you're choosing between patchouli or patchouli with bull testicle extract. Which is,
I'll go for the bull testicle.
Exactly. I think most people, that's not a very difficult choice at all.
It's interesting, too, that the Japanese totally dislike musk because they think it's unclean because of reverence to the bull testicle thing. So it's interesting how they see our culture as being unclean in the sense that we smell unclean because of our musk preference. We think it's exotic and it can be used as an aphrodisiac. So then again, here's another ally of the animal kingdom. So,
There's this advertisement in Harper's Magazine every month, at least the Harper's Magazines I've seen in the past couple of months, towards the back, that's some sort of scientific discovery where if you wear this pheromone, and it's an actual like human pheromone or synthesized pheromone of humans, that they sell there's a men's version and a woman's version, and there's all these testaments to the fact that like it attracts the opposite sex like nothing else would if you wear this particular
testament.
Fragrance.
Yeah, it's funny that you would say testaments, because testaments comes from testicle.
Testicle, and also I think that perfume brand name is called Erection.
Erection. The one I'm talking about?
No, that would be the per... No. No, I wonder, okay. You know how they usually do it reverse? Like,
I suppose what? Perfume comes from prr, and then fume, I suppose, as well.
So. Smell of the purr.
Yeah. Mm. Pure? It's pure
fume.
Like distilled oil, I guess.
Yeah.
We can make up our own little semantic theories here.
Yeah. I wonder if we should go to a cut and then back for this quote from Sir Lawrence Gardiner's article about Starfire in Nexus magazine.
Okie doo. So, Jason,
so this,
what's
this is
track?
Sort of non-topical track. It would have been more topical on the last show, but it's
we're gonna fast forward
David
for
Bowie
this one.
And Sonic Youth together.
Which produces more virulent sperm and
sweeter semen. Yeah.
Sweeter semen.
For that better secretion.
Facial. Yeah.
Let those secrets out now.
the secrets are coming.
You heard it first on Kootenai Co-op.
Kootenai Co-op Radio.
Also talking about androgyny, like bending your gender so that it's an ambiguous gender versus accepting your gender as a total gender and embracing both sides of yourself. So, in other words, we're just discussing the merits of like an actual bisexual representation of yourself or the acceptance of your opposite half. I think Dustin and I are in favor of being men, but being men who are very open and aware and listen to our feminine side versus going to that place where we dress like a woman and a man at the same time all the time and consider ourselves both at the same time.
Yeah, I don't want to cut it off. I like being a man myself. Yeah.
Yeah, and interchanging and playing with those roles, maybe, you know, like unemotionally attaching ourselves from them and just playing with them and seeing how they feel, putting them on for a little bit and trying to kind of see the other perspective that's going on. Perhaps if more men out there were to like take on, you know, a few hours of you know, thinking about what it might be like to have cramps or or, you know, to really want to just howl at the moon and sit down and cry once in a while, you know, there may be a little more compassion, you know, crossing over the boundaries there.
It's that warrior healer kind of thing again. You have to balance the two parts there. And, you know, like, I don't know, like on a penis on the very end, there's those little lips right at the very, where the opening is. They're, like, very small, like labia. But on the woman, too, there's the clitoris. It's like the little part of the woman is on the very tip of the man's most male organ. And above the woman's most female part is the little penis. I think in one of the Chinese, it's one of the quotes from that book, it talks about men have, I can't remember, many men have died trying to climb the Himalayas, and many more thousands have tried climbing the small mound of a woman's clitoris. You know, like, men have, you know, gone after this one small mountain, you know? But I like the idea that the feminine is within the male and the male is within the feminine. At the very most sacred expression of a man or a woman.
And this relays back
look.
To the...
Look. Unzip your pants and look right now.
Are you both? You can be for only... Yeah, in ancient like Hindu tradition, even, you know, going back to Shiva, Shiva is known as a male-female god, you know, the greatest of yogis, and having bridged those gaps, brought in the two energies, balanced them evenly in the body and in the spirit. And this is like, that's, I mean, our world, we were talking a little bit earlier, I don't know if we were on the air at the time, but about the information, there's information out there about the matriarchy having been long ago... abusing its power, like women having abused their power towards men and using them sexually and then killing them and, you know, discarding them and like without any respect for the male side of this paradigm, and that we are now living the backlash, the patriarchal backlash, and we're now like at the tail end of a gruesome, you know, backlash where the men, having been so abused, turned around and, you know, did the same thing. So hopefully we're coming back into balance. And I think as we were talking, transgenderism and homosexuality and bisexuality is becoming so prevalent in our society. People are really, really wanting to tune into the balance, and we're doing it in our own way.
Well, I think just a quick note on that the balance and the healing is just sexuality. and because homosexuality, bisexuality, they're all kind of defining boundaries, defining blocks, defining hang-ups and such like that. And it's, versus simply sexuality, which is what we had before all these, like, church-imposed conditions.
We've been listening to a show from 2001. Ian Hunter passed away in 2002, about roughly a year after that show. And so we remember you, Ian. We love you. You've been listening to Fane of the Cosmos, Infinite Moment. Airs every Sunday between 10 and midnight. Stay tuned next week for more craziness. And we're on to the night loop.